Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Casanova has gone down in legend as one of the world's greatest lovers. The 18th century's real Casanova was, in fact, an extraordinarily skilled navigator of women's arts and much more. A one-time priest, con man, violinist, soldier, gambler, prisoner, intellectual, writer, and lover. This hour on Point, we look back at the full and very colorful life of Giacomo Casanova. Joining me now from London is Ian Kelly, actor, writer, and now biographer of Casanova. Just a few hours ago, The Pitmen Painters, a London production about miners who become celebrated in the art world, in which Ian Kelly was one of the stars, was named Best New Play by the prestigious Theatrical Management Association in London, and congratulations on that. Kelly's new biography is Casanova, Actor, Lover, Priest, and Spy. London's Sunday Telegraph calls it a great blast of a book, rippling with enthusiasm right down to the final footnote. Ian Kelly, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. The Times of London says there are basically two types of womanizer when they reviewed your book. One motivated by hatred, the other by love. Casanova, they say, is the second kind, and I guess you're affirming that 6 ways to Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, highly and completely. A man who adored women, adored all mankind, though, all humankind. I mean, it seems to me, if anything, that was something of the secret, if you will, of his appeal, was that he had an absolute fascination for people and for getting to the kernel of them. It was makes him such an interesting writer on so many levels about so very many things, which hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about, because it's so much more than just love or indeed sex. But, you know, somewhere I think in his attention to detail about people is maybe the secret of his attractiveness.
Born,
he used to say he.
Yes, please.
No, I was going to say he claimed he was never even handsome. He was never attractive. He just he used to say I was never handsome. I just had an unbridled belief that anything was possible. I had a wonderful attitude in life. I mean, a great attractiveness, I think, around his sort of positivity. But yes, he adored women because he adored humanity.
Maybe not classically handsome, but no, I don't know how you could call him not attractive when you look at the record of his life. And you tell us right from the start, Ian Kelly, that we can't really understand Casanova without understanding Venice in the 18th century. He lived from 1725 to 1798, and the culture of Venice kind of had everything, its theatricality, the whole picture there had everything to do with understanding where Casanova and his kind of view of the world came from.
Yeah, I mean the thing is, Tom, the sort of history that I think is important and worthy to write about now is not only something which is very specific to then and to the specificity of them, but is somehow, you know, connected to now. And that issue of theatricality and artifice, there was absolutely Casanova's world as a Venetian and also as somebody born, in effect, out of the theatre. It kind of spoke to me because, as you alluded to earlier, I'm also an actor. I must correct you boastfully, actually, that it was the Evening Standard Award we just won a few hours ago.
Wonderful.
We've won the TMA already, a whole series of Best Play Awards, but there we go. His theatricality, his background as an actor, I think really informs the way he writes in a very modern way, because his importance as a writer, it's rather difficult to overstate. People just know about the romance and him as a lover. But it's one very small part, in effect, of his attempt to tell the totality of things, you know, as he sees it. And one of the really modern issues in all of that is his interest in the way that we as people all perform, you know, have a kind of an inner life and then an outer persona. He's very he's very kind of Freudian in that respect. And that issue, yeah, is all born, I argue, out of his Venetianness and his background in the theatre. But the fact is, actually, he spends very little time in Venice. Most of his life, he's on the road.
An inner life and an outer persona, almost Freudian in the sense that in his amazing memoir, nearly 3,600 pages of memoir, kind of overwhelming, in which he conveys detail after detail, this written later in his life when his years of travel and conquest were more or less behind him, he writes very, very candidly and frankly, more openly perhaps than anyone ever before him, about his sexual life and sexual motivations and how core or central they were to his understanding of himself and his life. He broached it.
Indeed. I mean, it's hardly been done before, and certainly I think he stands as one of the really important voices in the birth of now. I don't mean to get sort of overly serious about all of this. It's not like he's, you know, creating the rights of man or the American Constitution. But he is, you know, out of, in a sense, some of those same impulses of rationalism and an attempt to be, you know, an encyclopedist of everything. He records everything in a rather unjudgmental sense, and that happens to include his sex life and his love life, which obviously, you know, it's a core part to, we all know what it is to be alive, what it is to be a, you know, an adult human being. It's part of all our psyches, no matter what we choose to, you know, act upon. And that issue, the way that he is keen to explore that about himself, is very, when I say it's kind of Freudian. The interesting thing is, you know, it's his doctor, when he's an old man, who suggests he starts writing as a sort of cure for his melancholia, almost in a, you know, psychiatrist's couch sort of a manner, which is why he writes so much and writes too much. I mean, it's not really for publication, it would seem. It runs to 12 volumes when it's eventually published, but it doesn't even come out until, you know, the 1960s in its entirety. Mm-hmm. So it's a monumental work, and hugely exciting for me as a biographer, of course, to have that kind of detail. I know more about Casanova than I do about, you know, my family, my brothers, my, you know, my wife, my ex-girlfriends. There's nobody who's ever bothered in my life to try to explain themselves as fully as, you know, Casanova did, through a sort of tragedy, in a sense, that he had too much time on his hands and had the wherewithal to try and write it all down. And as it happened, he'd had a tremendously exciting, very adventuresome life as well.
Paint the broad mural of that. We're going to dip into many details and angles of it. But here he was, born 1725 to an actress in Venice. Give us the kind of two-minute broad stroke of this life, and then we'll come in closer.
Yeah, it's a sort of rags to riches to rags again sort of a story. Born on the wrong side of the tracks, he's the son of an actress, which is a very disreputable sort of reputation and position. And born in Venice in 1725, and there's not much money in the family. His father, if indeed it really is his father, we don't know who his natural father even was, dies when he's quite young, and his mother tries to support them, but she's away a lot. And he is maybe going to train for the priesthood. Certainly his family is keen for him to do that. But that all goes awry, and he launches on a whole series of sort of madcap careers and adventures. And in brief, I suppose, is maybe cursed in life by sort of early success. He's a very talented individual, very brilliant. He would be rather appalled, I think, by his reputation now, because he was so many other things. And out of that, he actually managed quite early on to make a small fortune.
He started the National Lottery, or the lottery in Paris.
Yes, which is a canny way to make a bundle of money in the 18th century.
Very engaged in numbers and math. You call him a fiercely proud intellectual polymath. Worked at different times as a violinist, soldier, alchemist, faith healer, librarian, originally trained, as you say, to be a priest, and geographically all over, out of Vienna,
all
of Venice,
St. Petersburg,
but hardly stuck
and London,
there.
And yeah. all over the then-known world. At one stage, also indeed contemplates going to America, if only he had. But it's all over Europe in the 18th century, in that tremendously exciting period, the Enlightenment, the age of reason, the lead up to the French and American revolutions, such an age of turmoil and excitement. But he loses nearly everything and ends up as a librarian in distant Bohemia trying to write, would you believe, a 5-volume science fiction novel, set partly in England, actually, and the rest of his time writing these memoirs.
You quote F.W. Barthold in 1846 saying, Casanova's memoirs form the most complete picture of the century preceding the French Revolution and a mirror of life, the innermost secrets of the life of man and an era. And of course, Ian Kelly, there's the number, 120 or 130, whatever it was, his conquests, if that's the right word for them, but seduced women in his lifetime that made him most famous all these centuries later.
Well, yeah, it's all kind of a posthumous fame, Tom, is the funny thing. It gets published a generation, in effect, later. And certainly in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, the first publications of the Casanova memoirs are almost put out as erotica, if you will, although it's never explicit. And there is actually not nearly as much sex as you might imagine, which I was keen to say and to kind of put in context, because this is a revisionist piece, a reappraisal of Casanova as a chronicler and as an important figure in this period. But in the course of that, the thing to say is, oh, we're getting some music coming in. How lovely.
the thing to say, Ian Kelly, we've got to take a short break. We'll come right back to that. The new biography is Casanova. Ian Kelly joins us from London. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life and loves of Giacomo Casanova, the original ladies' man, maybe. And it turns out a whole lot more than that. Ian Kelly, his new biographer, joins us from London. The biography is Casanova, Actor, Lover, Priest, and Spy. Here's just a little bit from the 2005 film Casanova, with Heath Ledger seducing a young woman in a convent.
Don't believe what people say. I don't conquer. I submit. I've never sought glory as a lover.
Well, what then, Signor Casanova, do you seek?
A moment that lasts a lifetime.
I don't conquer, I submit, Heath Ledger says as Casanova in 2005. Ian Kelly, what about that? I don't conquer, I submit. What was his approach to women?
It's a pretty near quotation, in fact. And he certainly talks, you know, early on in his romantic life about the extent to which he felt himself more the seduced than the seducer. And certainly that idea of trying to, you know, live every moment, suck the marrow out of life, just be open to adventure is part of what explains his romantic trajectory. I mean, he's traveling all the time in an era when people are, you know, forced together in very intimate circumstances on the road through Italy and France in particular, sharing carriages for days on end, sharing beds with complete strangers, all of that. But beyond that, as I was saying earlier, he also intellectually was completely fascinated by getting to the core of people. And at one stage said also with women, what he loved to do was to try and work out what it was that might be making them unhappy and then try to solve it. And it was a kind of a pathological pleasing that I began to get off of what he was saying about his life and romantic career. But the other thing I was thinking, I hadn't maybe explained well enough earlier on, he's so rubbished in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, in the English and American traditions in particular, as a chronicler, and maybe because of the extent to which he writes about love and about his affairs, I think we are maybe suspicious slightly of men who do that. But I wanted to say straight away that more and more everything kind of adds up in his in his favour as a chronicler of record. And he, I think, would be appalled with this idea that he's thought of now as sort of indiscreet or ungentlemanly. He does try to hide the identities of many of his lovers, indeed. But in any event, as I say, wasn't necessarily intending this for publication anyway. And as a result of all of that, you know, tries to present the whole man. I mean, I came across him, in effect, through his food writing. Not many people are aware of this, but I wrote a book about Napoleon Chef, and Casanova is one of the most important voices on the history of food throughout Europe, because he travels so much, but because he tells us what people ate. And nobody else is particularly bothering to do that of that period.
And he tells us in a way that practically puts that food and the eating of it on a par with the sex that he chronicles as well.
He constantly connects the two. I mean, this is a wonderfully sensual, sensory age, and it's one of Casanova's intellectual interests is trying to describe the sensual, if you were. And certainly, I mean, you know, he has a great appetite as a lover of food as a lover. And connects the two instinctively and constantly.
You write of him, he had been an artist of the immediate with a singular talent for happiness, which was part of what people found attractive in him. You say, people fell for Giacomo Casanova, people who could offer him preferment, money or good times, complicity of soul, the delights of the table, or the simple clock-stopping, heart-burning, tumescent pleasures of the flesh.
Gosh, did I write that?
You did. Where did he stand? I mean, in the mores of that time, was he seen as a scoundrel? Was he traveling because he was run out of town after town for his seductions?
No.
Was this just expected of a man of his, ultimately his station, or what?
Not at all run out of town, not at all even really considered a libertine in the classic sense of the period. He's no Marquis de Sade, certainly has no interest, it seems, in coercive, let alone violent or sadistic or masochistic areas of sexuality. But he is living, it would be said, in a world with maybe a different attitude to love as well as to sex than perhaps that which has existed more recently. I mean, for instance, it's before the Romantics. It's before an idea that there might be or should be just one great love that will dominate our lives, and that indeed would be allied most happily to a marriage. I don't think that's the way most 18th century city folk in particular thought or indeed behaved. And they kind of play game as a sort of a love as a sort of a game. They have this image of Cupid constantly, of this sort of idea of the little kind of prankster god that is throwing chaos into our lives from time to time, which I think is quite a, you know, sophisticated and true way to look at the experience of love and sex for some of us some of the time. And in his context, no. I mean, there are people, the people who write about sex of this period, many of them write about a great deal more of it than Casanova does. Boswell, for instance, Wilkes, Hickey, Lord Byron seemingly has more sexual partners in a couple of years in Venice than Casanova alludes to in an entire lifetime. What Casanova narrates largely are love affairs, and it's that is truly shocking, alarming, impressive, I don't know. He is a man who constantly falls in love or believes himself to be falling in love and is fascinated by the whole experience. He tells us a great deal, for what it's worth, about sexual failure, about the fear of disappointment.
When things don't work out.
Yeah, which is not something that most men are at all comfortable talking about or thinking about, even the fear of disappointing a lover or the idea of sexual or romantic failure. He tried to commit suicide when he was here in London. He went to Westminster Bridge to throw himself in the Thames weighted down his
because
with lead shot. Well, it's not just an unusual image, isn't it, for Casanova? But it's because he is disappointed in love. I mean, it's possibly complicated by a feeling of financial ruin, and and indeed something which spoke very horribly to me at the time. He said he said, aged 38, any man should know that it's all downhill from
now. It's all over.
Or worse to that effect. But luckily, he got over it. I know he was persuaded off Westminster Bridge by a passing British MP who took him for a kind of a slap-up meal in Covent Garden.
And so the memoirs were written, and so we know.
And so thank goodness. I know. History could have taken so many other wrong turns.
You quote just a bit from that massive memoir, the many volumes of his, about his first encounter. His very first sexual encounter. It happened to be with two sisters. I wish you'd introduce and read us a bit of it, as much as we can maybe deliver on air. But tell us about this and give us the flavor of it.
Well, indeed, to put some of this in context, Casanova narrates a series of encounters with sort of more than one sexual partner, which seems not so unusual of the crowded cityscape of 18th century Europe. But in any event, the first, I mean, the loss of his virginity, it's a memorable, you know, moment for all of us. But his story is very much within the context of this crowded Venetian world. He's actually been invited over for sort of a teenage slumber party, in effect, and manages to smuggle himself upstairs to the girls' room, two sisters, and they all pretend that they're going to go to sleep. And then he writes, "They had their backs turned towards me, and we were in darkness. I began with the one towards whom I was turned, not knowing whether it was Nanetta or Marta. I found her curled up and covered by her shift, but by doing nothing to startle her and proceeding step by step as gradually as possible, I soon convinced her that her best course was to pretend to be asleep and let me go on. So little by little, I straightened her out, and little by little she uncurled, and little by little, with slow, successive, but wonderfully natural movements, she put herself in a position which was the most favourable she could offer me without betraying herself. I set to, but to crown my labours it was necessary that she should join in them openly and undeniably, and nature finally forced her to do so."
Casanova's first time, in his own words, from Ian Kelly's biography, Casanova, and everybody lost their virginity on this particular night, Nanette and Marta and Giacomo.
Well, and indeed, and a couple of things to maybe point out that might surprise people. They remained friends for many years. Casanova remained great friends with a number of his lovers throughout his life. But also, the occasion is little more explicit than that. He is never pornographic. He is never very detailed. He is very interested in the sensuality, but also the sort of the tenderness of the moment, be it, for that matter, eating or laughter or the theatre, let alone the sexual and romantic acts themselves. So, you know, he gives us this extraordinary insight into what it was to be alive then, and partly it's just him as a social historian, which is of necessary interest to an historian, but actually he is very rare in bothering to try to, you know, elucidate what it is to be alive, what he felt it had all been about for him, writing largely in old age, but you know, from notes and from letters, and sort of seemingly you can glimpse the backstory of previous kind of diaries and journals and so on.
You write you say without apology or blush, he ranked his sexual and romantic adventures on a par with the rest of his intellectual, professional, and geographic odyssey, the first great writer of the modern period to do so.
I argue exactly that. That is his singular importance. I mean, gosh, it's a great romp of a story. It's
no
an
kidding.
Incredible
yes.
life, and it's a great, you know. And he meets Ben Franklin and Samuel Johnson and Catherine the Great and Frederick the Great and you know and the Pope and Voltaire and Rousseau. And
escapes prison
he
over the rooftops
everything.
Of Venice.
I mean, it's a boy's own adventure. It's absolutely fabulous. But in a sense, you know, anybody might have, well. Yeah, maybe anybody might have done that. What's really fascinating, I think, is that you get such a personal handle on it through this kind of revolutionary new take on the world of trying to take to pieces both the, you know, the internal person and the mask that they're wearing. And it is that that sets him as the kind of the original voice almost in modern memoir, modern biography writing. It's like, you know, if you really want to understand me, then you might want to address my interest in spirituality, my interest in food. You might also, of course, want to know about me sexually. These are the things that we open up to each other as lovers, maybe, in life. Mm.
There's the great story.
So few writers try that.
There's the great story of a Henrietta, I think in Switzerland somewhere. They have their affair. She etches with a diamond he had given her in the window of the lodge. I think, you know, you will forget me, Casanova. And many years later, he comes back and sees that still scratched in that window. Yeah. Has a kind of breakdown, as you report.
Well, indeed, and again, we have several testimony on the existence of this sort of, you know, little scratched. You know, you will also forget Henriette. This is one of the great loves of his life. A married woman, seemingly who had run away from her husband briefly, and they have that sort of, if you will, holiday romance that is you know somewhere beyond reality or the ties of the everyday, and both know that they have to give each other up. And he writes about it very beautifully. And they meet years later on the cusp of middle age, and it's a very tenderly wrought love story in the course of a life which, you know, looks like it's all about kind of scams and being kind of, you know, rambunctious and just, you know, trying to sort of, you know, get one over on everybody financially or perhaps sexually. But I was surprised by what a very tender man he was, and the extent to which he was so willing to expose his vulnerabilities to himself in writing this, and indeed to his lovers.
He even ends up in Mozart's Don Giovanni with his kind of rival for a reputation as a ladies' man, the Don Juan, Don Giovanni. He even intersects with the libretto, with the sort of writing the opera itself at one point.
Well, exactly so. This extraordinary moment where the man and the myth collide. Don Giovanni, the Mozart opera, the libretto is by Lorenzo de Ponte, who was a great friend of Casanova's. And there is a fascinating little story about the Casanova connection to the writing of that libretto, which I could tell now, or I could tell after hearing a bit of Don Giovanni.
We'll hear a bit as we go out, but it's amazing. Here he's got, of course, Mozart via the libretto has Don Giovanni bragging of his conquests, a couple hundred in Germany and 1,003 famously in Spain, and on it turns out.
It's such a slur on the womanhood of Spain. How cruel!
Well, but hundreds all over, and Casanova himself maybe with a little piece of that. Mozart's Don Giovanni behind me, Ian Kelly joining us from London. You can join us as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In Italia, 640. In Germania, 231. In Francia, in Turchia, 91, ma in Spagna, ma in Spagna, son già 1003. We're talking this hour about the life and loves of Casanova. And it turns out he was a very busy guy in many more ways than one. Ian Kelly joins us from London. He's author of the new biography, Casanova, Actor, Lover, Priest, and Spy. Ian Kelly, we heard a bit of Don Giovanni there, and of course there's the libretto where it's in Italy I had the 640, in Germany 231, in France, in Turkey 91, in Spain 1003.
Yes, the famous catalogue song, yes. which rather puts some Casanova's you know, 2 to 4 sexual partners a year in a different light.
Yes.
The interesting point, though, I guess here is the premiere in 1787 at the Estates Theatre in Prague. Casanova attended. He was a great friend, as I say, of Lorenzo de Ponte. What's intriguing is that he clearly had some collaboration with the writing of the libretto. There's not only some of the themes involved, although obviously the Don Giovanni story or myth is rather older. It predates Casanova. Mm. But we do know, it's a nice little story, that Lorenzo de Ponte was out of town, wasn't in Prague, when the last bits of the opera were written. And there's a lovely little story of Mozart, the composer, being kind of locked into this room by this irate Italian opera company, wanting him to finish this opera because they were meant to open the next week. And he eventually did. And it seems that somebody contributed a few extra bits and pieces to the libretto. And there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that that person would have been Casanova. And indeed, in the Prague archive to this day, where a lot of this book was written and researched, the everything that Casanova left when he died includes some beautifully presented notes for Act 2, Scene 2 of Don Giovanni. So here, as I say, at that moment in 1787, the man and the myth kind of crash together, because the ideas are almost synonymous now. Don Juan, a Casanova, a Lothario, it all gets kind of lumped together as a man who, you know, behaves wrongly towards women. I think Casanova, as I say, would be appalled by that gloss on his career. He was felt himself to be a great respecter and admirer of and lover of women, and is very far from being the sort of the Valmont figure from Les Liaisons Dangereuses or some, as I say, coercive libertine.
Ian Kelly writes, he had a large beaked nose and bulbous, heavy-lidded eyes, thick dark eyebrows, and a swarthy complexion, minuses all in the lexicon of 18th-century ideals in beauty. You write he was uncommonly tall, unusually muscular, for a man who never labored. Also references to the thickness of his neck, the prominence of his Adam's apple, suggesting, you say, a solid man, a manly man, for all he swathed himself in those days in lace. And you say, at his prime, his only boast was that he was convinced he or any man could conquer any woman if she was the sole object of his undivided attention. When he moved like a dancer, it was said. Casanova. Let's go to David in San Francisco, California. David, you're on the air.
Hey, across the country, here you be. Hey, Bob. I remember discovering way back then, I think it was the first edition, multi-volume, beautifully printed volumes of Casanova's biography, reading them volume after volume voraciously. But at the same time, I was also reading the many volumes, autobiographical for sure, although not called that, of Henry Miller, writing about the bohemian lifestyle, first in Brooklyn and then in Paris.
Paris,
in the 40s, and in Paris. And both of them encountering these two human beings and feeling that I was really knowing them across the year. Also reading Benito Cellini's autobiography, which is kind of similar in a kind of, if my memory serves me well, to quote Bob Dylan. And so I wanted to ask you, what to compare and contrast Henry Miller, 30s and 40s, writing many books around his life, and Casanova, and also mentioning that they were very beautifully printed, the Casanova biographies.
Wonderful. Let's stretch right across the centuries. Henry Miller's 1930s, 40s, 30s Paris, and Casanova. What do you think, Ian?
Well, one of the absolute joys of what I do or try to do is to make those empathetic leaps across the centuries. But what a joy it is when actually you can be in some of the places as well. And yes, I mean, Paris comes alive in a whole other way through the writings of Casanova, as does Venice or St. Petersburg. And I think it's one of the Is one of the gifts that you know, we can leave to the world is our impressions of place and of other people, and you know, maybe that is one of the finest things we can do, is to actually give that impression, and in particular, if we can give some of the human impression on stuff. I get occasionally, not exactly criticised, but it's commented upon, that these people I write about who apparently don't, you know, win battles or you know, achieve, you know, great things in their lives, but if it seems to me they leave some human record of actually what it was to live and to love, there is something immensely admirable about that. So yes, I'm with David on this. I know love nothing better than to just lose myself in the memoirs of another person, and ideally of another time. That's the sort of time travel that is possible.
You give Casanova a lot on this score. You say he wasn't an historian, but he really wasn't trying to write a romance in his memoirs. You write, the world he sought to understand was as much his internal landscape as Europe's on the cusp of a revolutionary age. I mean, Henry Miller, much after. But Casanova, you say, brings us this century before the kind of deluge of revolution changed everything. I mean, what was still alive then? What was the atmosphere that later would be almost unreachable?
Well, I think they were aware that the world was changing very fast because it was. There was a sort of economic boom through Europe of this period, the birth of the first great anonymous cities, and an absolute revolution in the arts and sciences that, in a sense, slightly, you know, predates the famous political revolutions, the American and French, and to that extent, you know, it's absolutely the birth of now, and he has a very special place in trying to give a kind of a, you know, a human angle to all of that. And I wanted to, you know, clearly state, because the message doesn't always get across, you know, he is not an unreliable memoirist. Just because he writes about love and romance doesn't mean he's being boastful or vainglorious. Like I was saying earlier, sometimes just the opposite. You know, he gets the dates wrong from time to time, but, you know, so do I from last week, and I'm rather forgiving of him for that. He's a very important, you know, chronicler, but as I say, on this rather rather human scale, such that he'll give you you know, the details of you know, of the sort of things you could eat at the Winter Palace before you bumped into Catherine the Great, having one of her conversations, you know, about the prospect of a revolution in America. I mean, those sorts of you know, really kind of human angles on things. It gives the proper taste of history, I think, and that that struck me as worthy, as well as, which we haven't had a chance to talk about, this this strange leap across the centuries. He was obsessed with the Kabbalah, of all things, a rather you know, lost area of 18th century, you know, esoteric Judaic mysticism, pretty much until relatively recently, and suddenly there's a lot of new interest in all of that. Maybe because we're interestingly mirroring the 18th century at the moment. I often think we're much more connected to them than we are to the kind of, you know, portentousness of the 19th century and all that, you know, serious, you know, Victorian and American sort of empire building. They were aware the world was changing and were sort of unsure of it and of themselves, and their spiritual quest, I think, is part of that, maybe, as well. And he, in his search to understand the medicine of the period, the alchemy of the period, also had a fascination in the spiritualism of the period, and particularly the Kabbalah.
Even the Kabbalah. Let's go to Burlington, Vermont, and Suzanne. Suzanne, you're on the air with Ian Kelly.
Yes, hello, how are you?
Fine.
Very well, I'm very well.
Yes,
hi there.
I have a quick question. I'm just wondering he fathered any children, and how many, and was he a parent to any children? That's my question.
How many children for Casanova? Not his strong suit, the parenting side.
No. As a father myself, I was particularly unimpressed with some of his attitude. He admits to 8 children and suspects that he has had more. It's pretty appalling in terms of not taking proper responsibility, except to say some other writers of the period, friends of his, the Prince de Ligne, for instance, comment upon the extent to which he takes better care of, takes an interest in his offspring in the way that would not be entirely expected of that era in those contexts, in that having affairs with actresses, for instance, who were beyond the pale of respectability. There wasn't an expectation that a child born of that affair would be supported necessarily by the father involved, for instance. It's unimpressive. He keeps up with some of his children, a daughter of his who ends up here in London, and a son in Italy. But it is not a major part of his life, and something I was uncomfortable with, but I certainly feel, you know, it's never my job as an historian to have too much of a moral judgment. I think that's always a mistake, you know, over the centuries, to try to put our a current morality onto a situation then. But yes, there are children, but no, there is no sense of creating a type of little family for himself.
I was surprised at how much birth control figured in, even at that early date. I mean, it was very much part of the conversation.
Well, indeed. Again, this is another sort of a new, I hope, aspect of aspect of the book in terms of Casanova, because we are able to be a bit more, you know, clear and honest about what was going on. And Casanova is terribly important in the history of contraception.
You loved your English condoms.
Absolutely. We Brits, I speak also as an Irishman, made the finest condoms in Europe in the 18th century. Who knew? Finally, British culture were, you know, valuable for something.
Made from what?
Made from sheep's gut. Mm-hmm. There you go. In Scotland, they made haggis out of it. In England, they rendered condoms. And these seemingly were kind of exported across Europe by the grand tourists, by these English aristocrats off on holiday. But the interesting point here, I suppose, is that there's a clear kind of parallel here with what goes on with the pill in the 1960s, in that there is a sort of a liberation possible in sexual mores in European cities in the 18th century, and an element of that is around these finely wrought condoms. And what Casanova writes about is the extent to which this frees the women of a fear of pregnancy. It isn't primarily, from his point of view, about sexually transmitted diseases. He's saying this is actually what's going to relax everybody about that fear. So to that extent, you see this very prescient attitude to the use of a prophylactic.
Tell us more, if you would, about a couple of his great conquests or loves. I don't know if those are the same in his view, but give us a couple more examples.
Gosh, well, some of my favourite stories from my book include Manon Belletti, who was the daughter of France's most famous actress, a great beauty. It's a very beautiful portrait.
Unbelievably beautiful portrait,
and,
Manon
she's
Belletti.
She's gorgeous, isn't she? Mm. Yeah, and she was engaged to Casanova. But I love that one mainly because I have the other angle on it, because in the Prague archive are all her love letters to him. He kept her letters all his life. And gorgeous they are too. Teresa Landi or Lanti.
That's an amazing
an opera
story.
Singer. Mm-hmm. And there's a beautiful portrait of her from La Scala in Milan that's in my book. And a wonderful moment of a Casanova story that also is this little footnote to music history.
But she was working as a fake castrato. Tell us that. I mean, she, that. please.
Yes, well, who'd have thought it? But when they met, absolutely, she was masquerading as a man for the sake of her music career. Mm. Because in the Papal Territories, which was quite a lot of Italy, you couldn't perform on stage. A woman couldn't do that. So soprano roles were taken by castrati. It's a rather distressing issue. But there was a Vatican choir, of course, also of castrati. But there was a rather more rarefied version, women who masqueraded as castrati for the sake of their musical careers. If you follow me so far, it all looks a little bit Shakespearean.
Yes, but he was dissuaded by this. He persisted until he learned that this man castrati was, in fact, beneath it all, a woman.
Indeed, and it's an extraordinary moment, unique surely in the history of letters and love memoirs or romantic literature, where they bear to each other their love for each other, their souls, their hopes for the future, and her, would you believe, fake penis that she was obliged to wear for fear that the papal authorities did a sort of spot inspection. So
it was undeterred to the last.
Well, indeed, it takes us into some rather bizarrely, transvestite, transsexual, fetishistic sort of areas, you might argue, of sexuality, except to say they had a love affair. He persuaded her to come out as a woman, and she went on to a wonderful career as a soprano and bore him his first child, and they remained friends all their lives.
Ian Kelly, we could go on and on, but I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Casanova outstrips us with his with his numbers and with the wonderful sort of endless texture of this life. You convey it so marvelously, and we're very grateful to you for being with us today.
Thank you. I'm passionate about him and this period, so thank you for a chance to talk about it.
Wonderful to have you with us. Ian Kelly in London. The new biography is Casanova, Actor, Lover, Priest, and Spy. We'll go out with just a little bit more of Mozart's Don Giovanni, Don Juan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.